Hello, everyone. Welcome to Overflow of Genius, a modest film discussion with Fareed and Raj. My name is Raj Ranadeh. I'm the film critic for the Lexington Ace Weekly, and I'm here with my friend Fareed Bin Youssef, a PhD candidate at Berkeley.
Hello.
Fareed, tell our audience a little bit about what you do over at Berkeley.
Well, you know, I love the movies.
It's true.
You know, I'm in the Department of Film and Media, and I sort of have found myself a sweet academic gig, if the words sweet and gig can ever go with academic, in that I've sort of stumbled upon this idea that, you know, post 9/11 anxiety manifests itself in popular American genre film, from your westerns, which has classically been considered to be the mythic texts of certain American ideals, film noir, usually its dark analog, to a new guy, what A.O. Scott has called the newer text of popular American cinema. That means the film type, the genre we hope to see over and over again work through on the big screen. That would be the superhero. So I tend to look at the political valences behind these very spectacular genres.
Now let's talk about the most political superhero movie of the summer, and probably the most interesting, I'd say, because, you know, the Avengers, the Hulk punching that one guy was fun, but kind of a wash, I'd say. Anyway, so Fareed, give us your thoughts about the Dark Knight trilogy in general, the Batman trilogy. What's special about it compared to other superhero movies, and why do you have such a high view of it?
Well, I think on the one hand, aesthetically, these movies have allowed Christopher Nolan to sort of develop his spectacular aesthetic, you know, with some sort of missteps. You know, no one loves a quick cut in a fight scene as much as a Dark Knight era Christopher Nolan. But, you know, on the one hand, it's interesting to see these movies just for the sheer spectacle of it, taken to extreme degrees within the last film. But I think more to the point, what these films suggest is the possibility that the blockbuster formats, particularly the superhero, can serve as some sort of allegorical reflection for the worst, the darkest American anxieties and realities that define us today. Using the superhero, something so safe as Batman, a guy with, you know, a cowl and a cape, to really start questioning issues as broad as torture, terrorism, the city after 9/11, all the way to issues of spectacular cinema in and of itself, and whether or not that it's simply a balm, a sort of an anesthetizing tonic that allows us to forget for a moment an American society that is not at all superheroic and not even superior, but that sort of eerie possibility after 9/11 that the American ideal has profoundly been weakened and ruptured. So I'd say it epitomizes for me a certain type of intelligent and even bold type of blockbuster form in the Dark Knight trilogy as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a political emphasis to these movies that I think is really just fascinating. Particularly, I think The Dark Knight is the best of Nolan's attempts at this, because it keeps this very strong and insightful focus on the issue of terrorism. In the movie, you have Batman, who is this wealthy, militarized sort of institution, going up against the Joker, who is basically completely unpredictable and just kind of deliciously evil. And it's this fascinating allegory of a time when the American military was going up against an enemy, a terrorist enemy, that did not play by any of the rules that that generally govern American military in combat. The Joker talks about in the movie, you know, the things that I like in this world are gunpowder and gasoline, and the only thing they have in common is that they're cheap. And so it was kind of this powerful reflection of a new era for American military power abroad.
Sure.
And so now we get to The Dark Knight Rises, and there's certainly plenty of political references here. You have secret prisons, you have terrorism in American stadiums, you have bodies hanging from the bridges in these horrible echoes of Iraq.
Right.
But the problem I had with this movie is that I don't think there's the same kind of focus that allows the film to build a coherent thesis about a single idea. The movie goes after Occupy, and I think it has you could very reasonably support the view that this is a movie that's very pro-Occupy and a movie that's very anti-Occupy.
Sure.
And now, Fareed, what did you think about, you know, the political ideas this movie brings to the table? Did you find it to be coherent, or did it bother you that it wasn't?
Well, it's curious, because after watching the movie, for the first hour at least, you get a sense that this is going to be a focused and fun follow-up to The Dark Knight. Oh, Nolan, the master of the bait and switch. We think we're going to watch a good movie, then bam-o! No.
And I should need to point out here that this is maybe the most of a sense of humor that Nolan has ever showed in any movie, especially through the character of Catwoman, who, you know, played by Anne Hathaway, is an absolute delight. And later we'll get to Cillian Murphy's really astounding cameo. But
stop it. I mean, but here's the thing. In many ways, you mentioned the film's humor, and I was, you know, with a filmmaker like Nolan, I think it's always best to sort of accept the possibility that these films are deeply self-aware, beyond discussions of symbols and what have you, all the way to the meta-texture of the movie, commenting of itself as a movie and sort of highlighting its own decisions. So in terms of this sort of schizophrenic attitude you pointed out when they were like, oh, Occupy movement, torture city, that seems to affect the film. I had to laugh that the movie loses that sense of sort of psychological coherence to some degree. Its focus, about an hour and some change into the picture, when Bane goes to a spectacle, that would be the football stadium that's highlighted in many of the trailers. And then proceeds to blow it to smithereens. And here, you have a breakdown of the spectacle, where the nihilistic ideas proposed by Bane, usually talking about the proletariat, the worker, the average Gotham or American citizen, become front and center within the picture, so that Bane's bravado film discussion of what a people should be sort of overtakes for a moment the spectacle, quite literally. We no longer care about, you know, the sort of the incredible fun of a football game. We're forced to listen to his ideas. And I guess that leaves me. I mean, hey, I didn't mind it, but what did you think of that sort of that transformation that the film sort of took then, Raj, from this possibility of, you know, looking at just one aspect, one person's psychology, one hero's sort of struggles with a world that can no longer be controlled, into this more broader, more expansive essay film. Did you think that the film should have sort of stayed clear of tackling so much ideas, or is it to its credit that it had the ambition to do so?
I admire the movie for its ambition in trying to go after all these different, you know, ideas and plot strands. I think my issue with the movie at that point is that, yes, the, you know, Bane's speechifying takes over the spectacle, and that wouldn't be so much of a problem if the plot didn't kind of lose pretty much all coherence at that point, too.
Okay.
If you look at Bane's plan in this movie, it's first, he wants to destroy the island of Gotham because they're sinners and they need to be cleansed from the earth. But first, he's going to take over the city and then try to give them hope. Or, you know, so at least his speeches would say that he's trying to give them this populist uprising.
Sure.
While at the same time, I guess hope means murdering their football team and plunging them into anarchy. So
right.
It's a very confusing back and forth there. And blockbusters like this, I don't really know that they have to have a coherent set of ideas.
Right.
I thought back to a movie that it's not really a blockbuster, but it is an action movie. It's called Children of Men, the Alfonso Cuarón movie from 2006, I believe.
Sure.
And it's a movie where there's all kinds of political allusions kind of littered throughout the film. In the background, you see prison camps and religious fundamentalists kind of going wild, and echoes of modern terrorism.
Sure.
And none of it's really fashioned in a way that makes an argument besides things are going to hell. But, I mean, the thing about it is that there's a feel to it that feels very real and gripping, because the illusions all fit together in this scheme that makes sense. And in The Dark Knight Rises, you know, the illusions are all there. I don't know if they necessarily make that much sense, because Nolan pulls them in so many different ideas. The
sure.
Occupy thing. You have...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I think what you have here, maybe I'm wrong, But I think it's very smart that you pull out Children of Men, because I think both have a very different philosophy in how these big budget pictures should tackle the sort of tensions and sort of anxieties of the day. You know, both deal with terrorism, what have you, sort of a city in strife, one London, the Children of Men, the other Gotham City. And it reminds me of a philosopher, I think Slavoj Žižek, who in discussing, I know, why not, academia, who? No, but I think at one point in a YouTube video, which you can all watch, it's quite fun, he sort of talks about the effectiveness of the illusions within the film of Children of Men, i.e., why did it feel so real and grounded? Why were we never pulled away? And I think he argues that it's because Cuarón smartly, perhaps, or at least very differently from Nolan, puts all these references within the text, but obliquely. The idea being that the very moment you look at something directly, you say things like, hey, we have a problem with terrorism, or we have a problem with X, the audience will pull away in an odd way. The idea is, if you put it obliquely, it's part of the general tapestry of the aesthetic objects that we're seeing, and we're immersed, so that we're hit with those points about the contemporary condition on a visceral level, and we don't feel as though the filmmaker, in this case Christopher Nolan, is pedantically talking to us about these points. Do you think there's something to be said there in terms of his general approach to how a blockbuster should allegorize the contemporary moment more directly?
Well, first of all, let me talk about Zizek. You know, we dropped a philosopher's name, and but he is not a dry philosopher. If you go on YouTube and check out some of his videos, they are fascinating. He's basically kind of like he's a cokehead Plato. Let's go. That's the kind of the general demeanor of the man. You should take a look at his work if you can. But I think what's more effective in a blockbuster like this is that you can approach these things directly. Like, I think The Dark Knight itself did a very direct kind of approach that way.
Sure.
And I think it's mainly a question of and
why did you think The Dark Knight succeeded, if indeed it did?
I think there's a narrow focus to it that allowed it to have a single idea that was explored pretty thoroughly and given a pretty nuanced view of. It's the problem, I think, with The Dark Knight arises is that it's going in five different directions about every given idea it has at a given time. The Occupy movement, you know, at first it's this Anne Hathaway represents this view of she goes to the rich Bruce Wayne and she tells him, you're going to regret living so large and leaving so little for the rest of us.
1%! Yes! And I think I got
right,
it.
And so you think it's awesome because it's Catwoman and she's so great and she looks wonderful in a cat suit.
Right.
And then, but later in the film, then the Occupy movement becomes conscripted as this weird terrorist militia that takes over and almost destroys Gotham. And there's these kind of conflicting messages that they're interesting to think about, but they don't go towards a coherent idea that you can really wrestle with. I mean, it's the movie's it's flying off in so many different directions at the same time that you can't really explore an idea thoroughly. Another effective blockbuster, I think, that has really smart ideas, if you look at something like The Matrix,
right.
It's a movie where you have one central idea that the movie is sort of exploring over and over again, that you have this false world of technology and
sure.
media that rules everything in your life, and you have to break through it to find a different kind of reality that's more satisfying.
Right.
And I think because those movies limit themselves, because part of the thing is when you're working with a blockbuster, there is at least like maybe 40 to 50% of your movie that has to be dominated by some kind of explosions or gunshots.
Sure.
And I mean, that's part and parcel of the form. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing because I like explosions and gunshots.
Right, who doesn't? Yeah.
They go boom.
Doesn't.
Yeah.
Boom.
But you're limited in the time that you have to make an argument or explore an issue to any depth. I mean,
I think what I'm getting from you here is the possibility that that blockbusters can and have effectively, in the case of The Dark Knight and The Matrix, dealt with certain issues head on without the Children of Men restraint or obliqueness that Zizek references. But there's an explicit need for focus. There needs to be the possibility that in the blockbuster, which is sort of keyed into the necessary visceral elements of explosions, gunshots, the things that shock and go boom, there needs to be underneath that, if ideas are to be explored, a focus as clean as the and as I guess even logical, coherent as the action that takes place in A Dark Knight or in The Matrix. There needs to be a synthesis between the two.
I think so, and one example for that theory, I think, is the most effective kind of theme in this movie is about the value of symbols. You know, this movie, if you look at the end of The Dark Knight, you had a movie where you had this sort of utilitarian ethics going on where Batman decides to prop up this monster Two-Face that was once this great Harvey Dent, this great police officer, and make him into this symbol of hope, even though in truth he was basically a monster who was murdering pretty much indiscriminately. And but the idea here is that better to have some symbol of hope than nothing at all. And when you get to The Dark Knight Rises, it rejects that idea completely. It says that you can have this temporary gain that's built on this foundation of lies, but that's a corrosive thing. Literally, in this movie, you have this underbelly of Gotham that's created with these seething criminals, Bane's entire underground network. On top of the streets, they make a big deal about how the streets are clean thanks to the Harvey Dent act that was based on his symbolic value. But it's not a system that can hold, and eventually that underbelly comes out and reveals itself. I think by the end of the movie, you have this attempt to, by Batman, to atone for his sins and kind of provide this genuine symbol of himself instead of this false symbol. Telling the truth about what happened to Harvey Dent and then providing this real honest hero that can provide this hope that's a really kind of genuine and moving force.
Part of the reason I think you're going to get the, you know, the confused aspect of the film, and I think, is how the truth is presented here. In a way, when I was watching the picture, because, you know, you think truth, Hollywood movie, truth is good. But then you remember the truth of 9/11 was Abu Ghraib, you know, with all this, with all these things you talked about obliquely, which, you know, I mean, going all the way back to Vietnam and the Phoenix program, you know, the sort of the controversial sort of executive actions that were taking place clandestinely abroad.
Sure,
you know, having
the Gulf of Tonkin or whatever, right?
Oh, all these awkward business. But the fact is that they became really front
and
center.
What we're trying to say is that Vietnam was a bad time. That's our general argument.
This is the original thinking you have from a pair of young film critics.
You're
Vietnam,
welcome.
I watched Platoon. I remember what it was like to see that on DVD. No. But generally thinking, in part of the sort of the confusion is that of this moment of 9/11 is the possibility that truth can corrode in a way that, you know, that it reveals symbols to be just that, just facades that are covering nothing, that's worse than representing something falsely, can just simply be empty. And I can't, you know, that's the thing with, I think the movie slapped me in the face in probably the most over-the-top moment of, like, this is an American symbol, accept it and deal with it, audience, is when you have a young boy who sings the Star Spangled Banner, and as, you know, Bane sort of rises from the bowels of the city into the arena, which he will soon destroy, upon hearing the boy sing beautifully, he remarks, "A lovely voice." And hearing his aesthetic critique...
Free's available for Bane impersonations if you need
right,
someone, so...
You know, I'm just saying, you know, you can record a different ending of the movie with me that doesn't show Bane turning into Lawrence of Arabia. But just to go back for a second, that idea that, you know, that this Star-Spangled Banner is nothing, is not a national symbol, not representing greatness, but merely an aesthetic, something lovely, a tune, as it were, I think really profoundly sort of gets at a film that seems at odds or struggling in an interesting way. I think it's very incoherent, suggest its intelligence, because on the one hand, yes, truth is positive. Let's reveal Batman for what it is. But remember, the person who reveals the true aspects of the Dent Act happens to be Bane, who's very announcement of that truth leads the city into chaos. Is it possible, Raj, that in the muddle of ideas, the film sort of proposes more interesting possibilities of the inherent complexities of the moment that almost subverts the very simplicity of of the form of spectacle that it operates in?
Well, I mean, if you go to the ending, I mean, there is a really interesting kind of kink in the way that that sort of casts a shadow on everything that came before it. Because towards the end of this movie, you have a lot of people being inspired by the vision of the bat symbol, because Batman has returned to Gotham, and he set up a giant flaming bat on a bridge, which apparently was above a bunch of American soldiers who were stationed there, so that's confusing. But and then you have a bunch of kids using little chalk bats and drawing them around as a symbol of defiance and resistance against oppression. But that symbol is, by the end of the movie, it is again a lie, because Batman takes this nuclear bomb that has been planted under the city by Bane. It's been converted from his own green energy thing, because Nolan hates green energy too, I guess. Anyway,
and full disclosure, the nuclear bomb business, as much as I was like, interesting movie, oh, impressive, it's the one point where you think that Nolan might have sort of regressed as a filmmaker in trying to sort of load the third act with some sort of suspense. It smacks of a sort of a lesser action film in many ways, as a just as a convention.
Like the Avengers, which basically has ripped that exact same ending from, where he sent a missile into an interdimensional rift instead of a nuclear bomb to the ocean. But tomato, tomato.
I don't know how much a movie can rip off something that was released a month before it. But yeah, sure, why not? Let's.
They all know each other. They hang out at parties and whatnot, I believe. So.
Yeah. Definitely. But yeah, continue. Sorry.
So you have this symbol that's, oh, now it's finally based on truth, and now this is a valuable symbol. But at the end of the story, Batman is alive, and you know he pretended to die for his city and provide this sort of final lasting heroic sacrifice. But even that's a creation. That's a myth that he's created, and it's less overtly manipulative than making Harvey Dent a symbol, but it is still very much a manipulation. I mean, do you agree about that ending, Fried, or?
It's odd, because I think in some ways, you know, this possibility, like, I think that Bruce Wayne and Batman never fully understand what Joker or Bane are actually saying about them.
Because Bane's voice is very muffled the whole time.
That's right. And he just really is not catching most of what he's saying. Something to do with hope and this, I don't know, really. But no, I think, you know, you're leading on something about sort of how symbols operate, which is the possibility, and this I think gets to the most sort of searing meta commentary that Nolan seems to be making. He as much as he gives us the happy ending so that we walk away thinking, oh, Bruce Wayne's alive, the symbol lives, hooray for symbols, and maybe it's only effective as a symbol, oh wait, does that just undercut his whole philosophy, is the fact that both Bane and to a lesser degree Joker, and perhaps the best sequence of the trilogy, which you would think, is that like an action sequence? No, I mean, given that just to give you a sense of the sort of higher intellectual plane that these blockbusters seems to be operating in, the best sequence just might be the interrogation sequence in The Dark Knight, where Batman is with Joker in fluorescent lights, right? So that we see here in this very moment Batman in the antithetical domain of light, which the film of The Dark Knight Rises shares as the dominant color palette. There are a few shadows in this movie. It's almost as though Nolan wants to bring out the symbol of Batman into the light, so we expect it, and we inspect it, and sort of see just how deep, or perhaps how shallow it actually is. And there's that moment where Joker starts talking about various sort of things, and frustrating Batman, so he begins to punch him, begins to operate in the role of the hero, and in the most deliciously subversive moment where this is the superhero movie, Batman's punching the Joker, Batman's captured in a low angle shot looking strong, oh, high angle on Joker, so he's rendered weak. What happens? The Joker laughs and laughs as he's being punched, as though this symbol is utterly impotent, and if anything, just promotes something terrible by its very existence. Which brings me to the third film. And very briefly, given that this has become a full diatribe,
we're going to be staging a radio play version of The Dark Knight after this. Free will narrate.
That's right. It's called Fair Use, people. Deal with it. No. It's where you have that hope and despair line, which is, I don't think, going back to what they don't understand, what Bruce Wayne, Batman doesn't understand, which I think Bane posits, Batman is a symbol of hope. And in some ways, Bane suggests the hope merely feeds into the despair and plunges you into the darkness. What Bane needs from Batman, what Joker needs from Batman, is their very existence. Because in their very existence of goodness and sort of hope, or you know, of sort of righteousness, they're hiding something deeper. They're hiding a darker reality. They're feeding that into it. They are a gloss that's begin by their that seems almost too thin to hide the full darkness of contemporary American culture. And Raj, if you permit me, the meta implications are startling for the following reason.
What are the meta implications? I'll bite.
Thank you. One feels in that line, hope is versus despair, i.e. Batman is the hope which fuels the despair, that Nolan labels the entire superhero myth as a mere balm to cover up the fear created in a reality where all other national myths, from U.S. as a beacon of human rights to economic superiority on Wall Street, where all these national myths seem to lose their reassuring grasp. What we finally realize looking at this is the possibility that that Nolan is desperate to articulate that the superhero myth, in venerating strength and the possibility of an enemy that can be easily be defeated, it's merely a sort of lie, a facade in and of itself, as meaningless as the white knight that was Harvey Dent, that hid the darker but troubling reality of Two-Face. What do you think of that, Rock?
It's a very sad story, isn't it? It's very depressing, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there you go. So,
I mean, you know, there's something that that bugs me about Nolan's work is that sort of knee-jerk nihilism when it comes to you know, looking at everything. Because
right,
it's, I mean, it's one thing to say that the superhero is this kind of comforting myth that helps us shield ourselves from the darkness. But his pessimism in this movie extends to pretty much every reference he makes to anything. Green energy. Green energy is a ticking time bomb in Bruce Wayne's basement that will turn into a nuclear bomb. I mean,
except if you go to Florence, which apparently then you can escape. No wonder Woody
Allen.
Well,
Italy's very nice that time of year.
I know. I think what you're getting at, Raj, is less of an attitude of the superhero genre and more an attitude of even though you could argue that I mean, all his films have this dark, sort of unrelentless bleakness where heroes are false and what have you. But I think what it leads to, I think, is perhaps a very brilliant distillation of the essence of not just the superhero myth, but of Batman myth, which is that the superhero of Batman is less a sort of shining example of all things superhero than a strange archetype that's infused into a noir world. Because there's that relentless pessimism you speak of, where, you know, even all of its efforts to sort of say, you know, maybe there's going to be a positive change here or there, we can change it from the inside or what have you, seem like pipe dreams. Basically, I think, sort of articulate a superhero in the Nolanverse that is part and parcel with film noir. And do you think that sort of allows the sort of, if we think of it more archetypically, to have a greater resonance? Or do you find instead that sense of bleakness suggests a filmmaker whose cynical ideals render him incapable at this juncture of presenting a fully complex and satisfying view of the reality he so strives to document?
I don't necessarily mind Nolan's pessimism because it does set up this kind of nice gloomy mood, but you brought up noir. Noir usually works in its own kind of self-contained mini-universes. If you're going to continually be bringing up these tokens of the real world, I mean, the knee-jerk bleakness seems like an empty pose, because in reality, these are complex issues, and Nolan kind of too often gives them this sort of cheap, everything is terrible kind of dismissal. I mean, it's the weird tossed-off value judgment nature of the thing that bothers me more than just the regular reference itself. But in any case, we're winding down on time here, but Fareed, I think, wanted to advance what he declared to be a particularly crazy read of this particular Batman movie. Mm-hmm. So, Fareed, you want to take it
away? Before we go, it's going to be quick, Raj. I know we've ranted and sort of wound our way through the series and thought about it in such odd depth, more so than perhaps Nolan and Goyer themselves. But I got to tell you, I remember, because I was a fan of the whole "this is bitterly noir, green energy's terrible, football is terrible." I mean, I liked that the negativity while I was eating my popcorn. It seemed like a it was like a sort of a, like a goth student in like the apparently this is not my students that I may or may not be teaching, but you know that type of bitter kid that's always saying, "You're wrong, man. The system is flawed." It felt that was Nolan's voice to some degree. But you know that ending where we're in Florence and we see Bruce Wayne finally happy, distanced from the symbol which has brought him so much pain, and you know perhaps in Florence under the sun, in a cream-colored suit, he looks good, is finally able to be himself. And I remember thinking, really? Is that real? I mean, I get it. I get you on some positivity here. But where's that negative Nolan that suggests the terribleness of everything? That, you know, Memento's hero is nothing but a murderer. Spoiler! Leonardo DiCaprio is living in a dream. In Inception, another spoiler. So my suggestion is, because the film introduces a dream sequence early on when Liam Neeson comes in to tell us a plot point that that we learn is simply a manifestation of Bruce Wayne's pained and addled psyche. The very fact that he introduces the possibility of a dream sequence within this very reality-grounded world suggests, perhaps, and given Inception as the precedent to this film, which greatly undermined its idealistic and happy ending with the possibility that it was all a lie, perhaps what we're seeing in Florence is not, I propose, is not Christian Bale and, or whatever his name is, Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle finally enjoying the fruits of their labor, freed for a happy ending in the sun, but the dream of a grieving and desperate Alfred Pennyworth, who lost his son and who lost his purpose, and Michael Caine staring at Michael Caine, staring not at Michael Caine, but at his Christian Bale, is merely seeing the lie he wishes to be true.
Now, I want to state at this point that the views of Friedman Youssef are not necessarily endorsed by the Lexington Ace Weekly as a whole. But you know, it's a very interesting thought, and you know, go ahead and take that home with you. So that's going to wrap it up for this episode of Overflow of Genius, a modest film discussion with Fareed and Raj. Feel free to post in the comments section about what you'd like us to talk about next. We were thinking about taking on the sort of hidden epic of 2011, this little scene film with Matt Damon, Anna Paquin, Matthew Broderick, and a variety of other talented cast members called Margaret, which is this fascinating, you know, post 9/11 story of grief in New York City. So we will probably have something to say about it. So
that's right. We're nothing if not consistent with what we talk about.
Anyway, that's going to do it for us. Thank you so much for listening. We hope to see you again soon.
Bye-bye.